Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into the weeds, looking at the deep structure of how humans communicate.
That's right. We're tackling the relationship between sound itself, the acoustics, and how we actually build meaning from it, the linguistics, the cognition.
And our main source material comes from a pretty significant event, right? The Parole et Musique Colloquium at the Collège de France back in 2008.
Yeah, a real powerhouse gathering. Thinkers from acoustics, neuroscience, linguistics, philosophy, all focused on this puzzle.
The puzzle being how speech and music, which seem built from similar stuff, sound waves, organized hierarchically.
You know, simple elements like notes or phonemes combining into complex things like phrases or melodies.
How do they end up conveying such different kinds of meaning? Or maybe, do they?
Well, that's the core question, isn't it? It gets into some classic debates. Is musical ability just sort of piggybacking on our language faculty?
Like an evolutionary add-on?
Maybe. Or is it, as someone like Steven Pinker famously suggested, more of an artifice cultural, a cultural invention?
Ah, yes, the auditory cheesecake argument.
Exactly. Something we invented because it tickles our cognitive pleasure centers. But it isn't fundamental in the way language is.
That's a pretty stark contrast. Cheesecake versus, well, a core cognitive ability.
It is. And then you've got the artist's perspective, maybe best summed up by Wagner.
Music begins where the power of words stops.
Right. The idea that music taps into emotions and structures that language just can't reach, while words handle the precise propositional stuff.
So our mission today for you listening is to unpack that. We're going deep into the physiology, the structure, the cognition.
To really trace how sound waves hitting our ears get transformed into the complex tapestry of human meaning, whether it's a sentence or a symphony.
Okay, let's start at the very beginning. The ear, we often think of it as a microphone, right? Just recording sound.
Well, yes and no. Christine Petty's work, for instance, emphasizes that it's not a high-fidelity recorder. It's an acoustico-electric system.
Meaning it converts sound waves to electrical signals for the brain?
Yes, but crucially, it actively shapes that signal along the way. It's not passive.
How so? I mean, isn't the goal accuracy?
The goal is useful information, which isn't always the same as perfect fidelity. For starters, human hearing has incredible temporal resolution. We can detect timing differences far smaller than needed just for understanding speech and quiet.
Okay, so it's highly sensitive, but you said it shapes the sound, it distorts it.
It does, and this is fascinating. It's actually an advantage. The system is highly non-linear.
Non-linear meaning what?
It means the output isn't directly proportional to the input. For one thing, it amplifies quiet sounds much more than loud sounds. This compresses the dynamic range, helping us hear both whispers and shouts.
Okay, that makes sense. But actual distortion, adding things that aren't there.
Yes. This goes way back. In 1754, the violinist Giuseppe Tartini noticed something odd. When he played two notes strongly, people heard a third, lower note that wasn't actually being played.
He called it the terzo suono, the third sound.
Exactly. We now call these combination tones, or more technically, products, distortion products. The ear literally creates them.
How? What's the mechanism in the ear?
It happens primarily in the cochlea, the spiral-shaped part of the inner ear. Specifically, tiny cells called outer hair cells play a key role. They don't just sense vibration, they actively move. They push and pull on the surrounding structures.
They physically change shape.
Yes, driven by the sound input. This active mechanical process amplifies the signal, especially weak signals. But it also introduces these non-linearities, these distortions, adding those combination tones to the signal sent to the brain.
Wow, and this is useful.
It's thought to help sharpen frequency tuning and enhance sensitivity. And we can even measure it. You know those newborn hearing screening tests?
Mm-hmm.
They often measure otoacoustic emissions. Those are faint sounds produced by the cochlea itself, generated by the activity of those outer hair cells. If you can't detect them, it suggests that amplification and distortion mechanism isn't working properly.
So the ear isn't just a passive receiver. It's an active, slightly distorting amplifier tuned for maximum clarity.
That's a great way to put it. It prepares the signal.
Okay, so the ear processes the incoming wave. Now let's talk about the structure of the sound itself. Jacques Bouvresse points us towards Hermann von Helmholtz.
Ah, Helmholtz, a giant. His theory physiologique de la musique was groundbreaking in the 19th century. He really wanted to put the understanding of music and sound perception on a solid scientific footing, moving away from, well, more speculative ideas.
And he focused on the physical composition of sound.
Precisely. He analyzed what makes up most natural sounds, like a vibrating string or a voice. It's not just one single frequency. There's the main pitch, the fundamental frequency, or F0.
F0.
F0, yes. Yeah. But on top of that, there are harmonics. These are frequencies that are exact integer multiples of the F0. So if F0 is 100 hertz, the harmonics are at 200 hertz, 300 hertz, 400 hertz, and so on.
And the combination of these harmonics, their relative strength, that's what gives a sound its character, its timbre.
Exactly. Timbre is why a violin and a flute playing the same note at the same loudness for the same duration still sound completely different. Helmholtz realized timbre is all about the relative intensity of those harmonics.
So one instrument might boost the second and fourth harmonic, another the third and fifth.
Right. And to perceive this difference, Helmholtz theorized that the ear must somehow act like a frequency analyzer. It has to decompose that complex incoming sound wave back into its basic sinusoidal components.
Like performing a Fourier analysis.
That was his insight. He proposed that the basilar membrane within the cochlea essentially does this. Different parts of the membrane vibrate more strongly in response to different frequencies.
Creating a kind of map.
It's a spatial map of frequency along its length. It's called the tonotopic map. High frequencies stimulate one end, low frequencies the other. So the ear physically separates the frequency components of the sound before sending that information onwards.
Okay, so the ear actively processes, it analyzes the harmonic structure, but then the brain takes it another step further, doesn't it? With this idea of the missing fundamental.
Yes. This is truly remarkable. It shows perception isn't just about receiving what's there. It's about constructing what should be there.
Explain that. How can we perceive a fundamental frequency if it's missing from the sound?
Your brain, or rather your auditory system, calculates it based on the harmonics it does receive. If the sound contains strong energy at, say, 600 hertz, 800 hertz, and 1,000 hertz.
Which are multiples of 200 hertz.
Exactly. They are the third, fourth, and fifth harmonics of a 200 hertz fundamental. Your auditory system finds the greatest common divisor of the harmonic frequencies present, and you perceive the pitch as 200 hertz. Even if there's zero acoustic energy at 200 hertz in the signal hitting your ear.
That's wild. Does this happen in everyday life?
All the time. The classic example is the telephone. Old analog phone lines had limited bandwidth. They often couldn't transmit the low fundamental frequencies of, say, a deep male voice.
But you could still tell the person's pitch was low.
Absolutely. Your brain just reconstructed the missing F0 from the higher harmonics that did get through. The voice didn't sound unnaturally high-pitched. It sounded like the person.
And this isn't just a human thing. You mentioned goldfish.
Believe it or not, yes.
Yeah.
This ability to perceive the pitch based on harmonic structure, even with a missing fundamental, is an ancient auditory function. It's been traced back surprisingly far in evolutionary terms.
Why? What's the advantage? Why evolve this complex reconstruction ability?
Several key advantages. First, grouping. It helps bundle all the harmonics coming from a single sound source together. Imagine two people talking at once. Their harmonics are all mixed in the air. Reconstructing the F0 for each helps your brain assign the right harmonics to the right voice.
Ah, source segregation, the cocktail party problem again.
Exactly. Second, estimating size. The fundamental frequency is related to the size of the sound source, think vocal cord length. Lower F0 generally means a larger animal. Useful for knowing if that sound in the bushes is a mouse or a bear.
Okay, survival value there.
Definitely. And third, as we touched on, robustness. It makes pitch perception incredibly resilient to noise or filtering, like the telephone example. It allows us to extract that essential pitch information even from degraded signals.
So the auditory system is this incredible biological engine, distorting, analyzing, and even constructing information to give us a stable perception.
Precisely. It lays the foundation for everything that follows.
Okay, let's build on that foundation now. How does this sophisticated auditory processing connect specifically to producing and understanding speech? We need to talk about formants.
Right. So F0 gives us the overall pitch or melody of the voice, the prosody. But the specific speech sounds, the vowels and consonants, depend on something else. How the vocal tract shapes the sound produced by the vocal cords.
Our mouth, throat, nasal cavity, acting as filters or resonators.
Exactly. The vocal tract is like a configurable tube with about 17 different points where we can change its shape, moving the tongue, lips, jaw, vellum. As the sound wave from the vocal cords, rich in harmonics, travels through this tube, certain frequencies get amplified because they resonate in the cavities we form.
And those peaks of resonance, those are the formants.
That's it. Formants are the characteristic frequency peaks in the spectrum of a speech sound. Different shapes of the vocal tract create different formant patterns. It's the specific frequencies of the first two or three formants, and crucially how they change over time, that largely define which vowel or consonant we perceive.
So while music might focus more on the stability and relationship of F0 pitch and harmonic fusion,
language relies heavily on the rapid dynamic shifts in these formant frequencies, occurring at a pretty sustained rhythm to create its distinct sound units.
F0 for melody, formants for the code. Okay. This code, these phonemes, they then get assembled into words and sentences using grammar. This brings us to the abstract rules, the syntax, Luigi Rizzi's work, drawing on Chomsky's framework.
Yes, the principles and parameters framework. This is a major theoretical approach in linguistics, trying to explain a fundamental observation. Human languages seem incredibly diverse on the surface.
Different word orders, different sounds, different structures.
Yet any child can learn any language they're exposed to, suggesting there must be some underlying shared foundation. Universal grammar.
The principles part of the theory.
Right. Universal grammar proposes a set of invariant principles common to all human languages that constitute our innate language faculty. This provides the basic toolkit for building language.
But how do we get the diversity then? That's the parameters part.
Exactly. Within this universal structure, there are specific points of variation, the parameters, which are typically conceived as binary switches. A language sets each parameter one way or the other during the acquisition process.
Like a switch for word order. Verb object or object verb.
That's a classic example. Some languages are VO, like English, eat apples. Others are OV, like Japanese, Ringo Otabaru, Apple's ACC8. This choice is a parameter setting. The key idea is that the vast complexity of language arises from a fifth set of universal principles interacting with a limited number of these parameter choices.
So what are the truly fundamental operations universal grammar provides? What allows us to build complex sentences at all?
The theory highlights a couple of absolutely core operations. The most basic one is often called fusion or merge. It's incredibly simple. Take two linguistic objects, say the and cat, and combine them to make a new larger object, the cat.
And you can just keep doing this, combining the new object with another one?
Recursively, yes.
Yeah.
Combine the cat with sat, then that with on the mat, and so on. This simple operation is what gives language its power to generate infinitely complex, hierarchically structured sentences. No known human language is limited to just simple atomic expressions.
Okay, fusion builds the structure. What's the other key operation? You mentioned movement earlier.
Right, movement. This is needed because very often where a word or phrase is logically interpreted in a sentence isn't where it's actually pronounced.
Give us that question example again.
Sure. Take, what did Mary buy? Logically, what is the object of buy? The underlying structure is something like, Mary bought what? But to form the question in English, the word what has to move to the beginning of the sentence.
So movement rearranges the pieces built by fusion for communicative purposes, like forming questions or focusing certain elements.
Precisely. And languages differ in what moves and when it moves, but the operation itself seems to be universal.
This connection between the parameters and the actual shape of words, the morphology, is also really tight, isn't it?
Yeah.
The verb movement example is fascinating.
It really is. This is where you see the abstract syntax connecting directly to the nitty-gritty details of language structure. The V to T movement parameter is a great case study.
Explain V to T again. Verb moving to tense.
Yes. It concerns whether the main verb in a sentence has to move syntactically upwards to merge with the tense marker, T. The trigger seems to be the morphological status of that tense marker.
So in a language like French,
where verb endings for tense are rich and act like affixes they can't stand alone, the verb root must move up to attach to them. That's why in French, the verb typically comes before negation or certain adverbs. Jean ne mange pas. John, N-A-G-N-A-T-S, not. Mange moves past pas.
Whereas in modern English, the verb usually stays put.
Right. Our tense endings, A-D-A-S-S, are considered morphologically weak. They don't force the verb to move. If we need something before negation, we insert an auxiliary verb like do, John does not eat. The main verb eat stays after the negation. Modals like will or can are already independent words in the tense position, so the main verb also stays put.
And the clincher is the historical evidence from English itself.
This is the really compelling part for the theory. If the richness of tense morphology causes verb movement, then if a language loses its rich morphology over time, it should also lose verb movement.
And that happened in English.
Exactly. As English evolved from Old English through Middle English, its system of verb conjugations became drastically simplified, a process called morphological impoverishment. And right alongside this simplification, English gradually lost the syntactic rule of V to T movement.
So Shakespeare could write, "He loves not," with the verb before not, but we have to say, "He does not love."
Precisely. The loss of the rich endings seems to have directly caused the change in the syntactic rule. It's a beautiful correlation between the sound form structure, morphology, and the abstract sentence structure, syntax.
And you see this cross-linguistically, too, with Icelandic versus mainland Scandinavian.
Yes, comparative evidence backs it up. Icelandic retains very rich verb agreement morphology, and it consistently shows V to T movement. Closely related languages like Swedish and Danish went through radical morphological simplification, much like English did, and they generally lack V to T movement today.
That's powerful evidence for this principles and parameters approach. If people want to dig into this, Rizzi's work is key.
Absolutely. Luigi Rizzi's research on the fine structure of the left periphery of the clause and the idea of a syntactic cartography is central to understanding these kinds of detailed syntactic analyses.
Okay, we've covered the ear, sound structure, and the abstract rules of syntax. But there's an even more basic question. Where did the units of speech, sound, the phonemes, come from in the first place? Why does language use discrete sounds like B, A, T, instead of just continuous whooshes and cries?
That's a huge question in language evolution. Pierre-Yves Oudia tackles this, arguing that standard natural selection, while necessary, might not be sufficient to explain the emergence of this combinatorial digital system.
So what's the missing piece?
He points to auto-organization, or self-organization. This is the idea that complex, structured patterns can emerge spontaneously in systems with many interacting parts without needing a specific blueprint for that pattern. Think of crystal formation or flocking birds.
Complexity arising from simple interactions. How does that apply to speech sounds?
Udayer uses computational modeling. He creates virtual agents, sort of like simple robots, equipped with simulated vocal tracts and auditory systems linked by neural networks. Crucially, they're given the ability to imitate sounds they hear and to adapt their imitations to get better.
So they babble and listen to each other.
Essentially, yes. They start by exploring their vocal possibilities, producing a whole range of continuous, messy sounds. But because they are motivated to imitate each other, and because some vocal tract configurations are easier to produce consistently and easier to distinguish perceptually,
the system starts to settle.
Exactly. The continuous space of possible sounds spontaneously discretizes. Certain stable configurations, effectively, phone-like categories emerge as attractor points in the system. The agents converge on using a shared, limited set of distinct sounds because those are the most stable and learnable points in the collective communication system.
It's like the sounds crystallize out of the continuous noise through social interaction and imitation.
That's a perfect analogy. It's a crystallization phenomenon. And the implication is profound. The emergence of a combinatorial phonemic system, which feels like a massive evolutionary leap, might not have required complex, genetically pre-programmed knowledge of phones.
Instead,
it might have resulted from a relatively small biological change, perhaps improving the ability or motivation for vocal imitation, represented by a parameter sigma nuttles, combined with the inherent self-organizing properties of neural systems interacting within a population.
So the building blocks of language might have emerged almost as a kind of physical consequence of having bodies that could make sounds and brains that could imitate interacting socially.
That's the intriguing possibility Udayer's work raises. It connects nicely, actually, with earlier functionalist ideas about phone systems, too.
Like Liljenkrantz and Lindblom's work.
Yes. Back in 1972, they showed that the vowel systems across the world's languages aren't random. They tend to use vowels that are maximally distinct acoustically, spreading out in the available vowel space to make them easier to tell apart. Udayer's model provides a potential mechanism for how a population might spontaneously converge on such an optimal, self-organized system.
Fascinating. It shifts the focus from just innate blueprints to the dynamics of interaction and emergence.
It really does.
Let's take these ideas about structure, context, and reconstruction and look at an extreme case. Simaram's work on African drum languages.
Yes, this is a fantastic real-world example of meaning being conveyed with incredibly reduced acoustic information. He studied the Bandalinda people, who use a special two-toned wooden drum, the lenga, to communicate complex messages over long distances.
Two tones, that's it. How can you send sentences with just two pitches?
Well, they don't just use pitch, they also use rhythm. The drum language essentially mimics the tonal contour, the sequence of high and low tones, and the rhythmic pattern, syllable durations, of the original spoken utterance in their tonal language.
But they lose all the vowels and consonants, the actual phonetic substance.
Completely gone. All that's left is the melody and rhythm played on two discrete pitch levels. As you can imagine, this leads to massive ambiguity.
Huge homophony. The same rhythm and tone pattern could correspond to dozens of different phrases with totally different meanings. How on earth is it intelligible?
That's the key question. Intelligibility relies heavily on two things: shared context and the internal structure of the messages themselves.
Context meaning.
The drum language isn't used for casual chat. It's reserved for a very limited set of specific, important social situations. Announcing a birth or death, warning of danger, summoning people, coordinating hunts, sometimes administrative things like tax collection. The listener already knows the likely topic domain.
Okay, that narrows it down. And the message structure.
The messages aren't just the core information. They are heavily padded with standardized, redundant, general formulas. These are well-known phrases like, listen carefully, or have you understood? Or specific ways to name the sender and recipient.
Like boilerplate text.
Sort of, but encoded in tone and rhythm. These formulas are long, their melody is familiar, and they act as signposts, framing the crucial, potentially ambiguous, specific formulas that carry the new information. The listener recognizes the familiar patterns of the general formulas, which helps them parse the message rhythmically.
So the listener isn't decoding phonemes. They're recognizing rhythmic chunks, using the known formulas as anchors, and then using the limited social context to figure out which of the possible meanings for the ambiguous part fits.
Exactly. Arad describes it as a cognitive process of rhythmic segmentation and then a selective recombination of possibilities, heavily constrained by the known formulas and the shared sociolinguistic situation. It's a brilliant demonstration that meaning construction can succeed even with drastically impoverished acoustic input, as long as there's enough structural redundancy and shared knowledge to guide the listener's reconstruction.
It really highlights how much meaning resides in the shared system and context, not just in the signal itself. Arum even compares it to a phonological system in its logic.
He does. He sees it as synchronically closed, using a fixed set of elements and rules, but diachronically open, able to adapt over time, much like the phonology of a spoken language. It shows the fundamental need for structured, conventionalized systems for complex communication, whatever the medium.
Okay, we've seen how structure allows meaning, even under duress. But this brings us back to the music versus language question. If they share so much hierarchical structure, reliance on pitch and rhythm, are they processed by the same brain systems? This is where neuropsychology comes in, right? Isabel Peretz, Regine Kalinsky.
Yes, their work, particularly studying patients with brain damage or developmental conditions like amusia, provides crucial evidence for dissociations between language and music abilities.
Dissociations meaning you can lose one without losing the other.
Exactly. If music processing simply relied entirely on language circuits, damage affecting language should proportionally affect music and vice versa. But that's often not what we see.
What kind of dissociations do they find?
Well, you can find patients who, after a stroke, for instance, lose their ability to perceive or produce melodies. They can't recognize tunes or sing pitches correctly, but their perception and production of rhythm might be perfectly fine. Or the opposite, intact melody, impaired rhythm.
So pitch and rhythm, key musical elements, can be independently impaired.
Yes, suggesting they rely on at least partially distinct neural resources.
And the classic, really striking example is the aphasic singer.
Absolutely. Many individuals with severe non-fluent aphasia, meaning they have profound difficulty producing spoken language, maybe can only utter a few words, can often still sing familiar songs quite well, with correct melody and rhythm. Some can even learn new melodies accurately.
Even though they can barely speak a sentence.
Right. This strongly implies that the neural pathways used for planning and executing the complex motor sequences of speech are different from those used for producing sung melody.
So this challenges the idea that music is just piggybacking on language modules. If there is some specific music module or specialization, what does it seem to handle?
Peretz's research, especially on congenital amusia people who are tone deaf from birth, points towards pitch processing, specifically the perception of pitch intervals and contour as being a core deficit.
So people with amusia often have normal rhythm perception.
Often, yes. Their primary difficulty lies in telling whether melodies go up or down correctly, or recognizing tunes they've heard before, because they can't process the pitch relationships accurately. This suggests that the fine-grained analysis of pitch structure, crucial for melody, might be a capacity more specialized for music than for language, which relies more on broader pitch contours for intonation.
Okay, that's evidence from impairments. But what about brain imaging in healthy people? Don't those studies often show lots of overlap between language and music processing?
They do show significant overlap, yes. Functional neuroimaging studies, like fMRI, often reveal activation in similar brain regions, wow. Auditory cortex, frontal areas, parietal areas when people listen to speech or music.
So how do we square that with the dissociation evidence?
The overlap isn't surprising. Both language and music involve complex sound perception, sequencing, memory, attention, maybe emotion. They naturally recruit overlapping general cognitive resources and auditory processing networks distributed across both brain hemispheres.
But it's not total overlap.
No. Crucially, almost all neuroimaging studies that carefully compare speech and music also report distinct areas of activation. There are regions that respond more strongly to speech than to music, and vice versa.
Can you give an example?
One finding is that singing familiar songs in unison with others tends to activate certain areas, like parts of the left inferior parietal lobe, more strongly than speaking familiar phrases in unison.
And that might connect back to the aphasic singers.
Potentially, yes. It suggests there might be specific neural pathways facilitated by singing that can sometimes bypass damaged speech pathways, offering a neural basis for why singing therapy can sometimes help people with non-fluent aphasia improve their vocal output. So the picture is one of shared resources and specific pathways.
It seems the brain is both integrated and specialized, and technology is pushing the boundaries of manipulating these signals even further. Xavier Rodet's work at IRCAM.
Ah, yes, IRCAM in Paris, the Institute for Research and Coordination in Acoustics Music. They've been at the forefront of analyzing, transforming, and synthesizing sound, especially the human voice, for decades.
Using tools like SuperVP, IRCAM corpus tools, what can they actually do with voice signals?
A remarkable range of things. Beyond basic analysis, they can perform sophisticated transformations. They can change perceived speaker identity, make a female voice sound male or vice versa, while keeping it sounding relatively natural.
Modify expressivity too, make a flat voice sound emotional.
Yes. Manipulating parameters related to pitch contour, timing, and spectral characteristics to alter the perceived emotional tone. They've even used these tools for practical applications in film.
You mentioned correcting pronunciation.
Right. The example of adjusting Gérard Depardieu's French-accented English for the film Vatel. They could subtly modify the formant structures associated with specific phonemes to make his pronunciation closer to a target native English speaker without him having to re-record lines endlessly.
And the really famous example is the film Farinelli, recreating a castrato voice.
Exactly. That was a huge challenge. Castrati had the lung power of adult males, but due to castration before puberty, the small vocal folds and larynx of a boy, allowing them an incredibly high range and unique timbre. Since that voice type doesn't exist today, they had to synthesize it.
Oh.
Using SuperVP, they meticulously analyzed recordings of a female soprano for the high notes and agility, and a male countertenor for different quality and lower range aspects. They then morphed and blended characteristics of the two voices' pitch, timbre, spectral envelope, vibrato, frame by frame, to create a seamless synthetic voice that convincingly evoked the legendary sound of Farinelli across his huge range.
Wow, that shows incredible control over the acoustic components of voice quality. And they can even turn speech into song.
Yes, that's another fascinating capability. Techniques like shape invariant modification in SuperVP allow them to take a recording of someone speaking and dramatically transpose the pitch upwards, maybe two or three octaves, and stretch the durations of syllables, effectively transforming it into a sung melody.
While keeping the original voice quality.
To a large extent, yes. It demonstrates that the core acoustic components, the fundamental frequency, pitch, the duration, and the spectral envelope related to formants and timbre, can be manipulated somewhat independently. You can impose a musical pitch and rhythm onto a spoken utterance's spectral signature.
It really blurs the line, showing how malleable vocal sound is when you have the right analytical and synthesis tools.
It underscores that both speech and song are built from the same fundamental acoustic ingredients, even if our brains and cultures have specialized them for different communicative functions.
So wrapping this all up, this deep dive really shows that getting from sound waves to complex meaning, whether it's the precise meaning of a sentence or the evocative meaning of music, is an incredibly intricate process.
It absolutely is. It relies on sophisticated, likely innate, auditory analysis mechanisms like reconstructing that missing F0. Then you have these highly structured, abstract generative rules like fusion and movement and language. And layered on top of that are the shared cultural conventions and contextual knowledge, like we saw with the drum language.
And the key takeaway seems to be that our perception isn't just a mirror of acoustic reality.
Not at all. It's an active construction. Like Purkinje said about vision reluder, the errors of the senses are the truths of perception, the distortions, the constructions, the filling in. That is how our brain creates a stable, meaningful, perceptual world from ambiguous sensory input. The illusion is the reality of perception.
For listeners who found specific aspects fascinating and want to explore further, let's quickly recap some of the key theoretical anchor points and names.
Sure. For the absolute basics of sound, pitch, and timbre perception, going back to Helmholtz's theory physiologique de la musique, perhaps via Bouveresse's analysis, is fundamental.
For how fern systems might emerge.
Pierre-Yves Zouhier's work on auto-organization is cutting edge, but it builds on earlier functionalist insights like those from Liljenkranz and Lindblom on maximizing perceptual contrast in vowel systems.
And the architecture of grammar.
That really takes you into the Chomsky tradition, specifically the principles and parameters model, with Luigi Rizzi being a key figure for understanding the detailed analysis of syntactic structures and variation, like that V to T movement parameter.
Finally, the music language distinction.
Isabel Peretz's extensive work on amusia and the neuropsychology of music is indispensable there, really probing the questions of modularity and specialization.
We started asking if music is auditory cheesecake or something more profound. The evidence seems to point towards shared roots, but distinct specializations in the brain.
Yes, they share the basic physics of sound and early auditory processing, but diverge in terms of which features they primarily exploit: dynamic formants and syntax for language, precise pitch intervals and contour for music, and likely rely on partially separate neural pathways for production and fine-grained perception.
But perhaps the most mind-bending idea comes from combining the auto-organization concept with insights about infant cognition, like those from Dehane Lamberts, showing brain readiness for hierarchical structure even before babbling.
Right. It suggests that maybe the magic ingredient wasn't the evolution of incredibly complex, dedicated language or music modules from scratch. Maybe it was a relatively small tweak, like enhancing our capacity for vocal imitation and learning within a social context.
Which was just enough to unleash the brain's inherent ability to self-organize complex, combinatorial, hierarchical systems from the bottom up.
It's a powerful thought. That all this richness of meaning we create might have bootstrapped itself from relatively simple changes, leveraging the fundamental properties of neural matter.
Which leaves us, and you the listener, with a final thought. As we increasingly interact with new kinds of minds AI systems trained on vast amounts of our language and cultural data, systems capable of sophisticated imitation and generation, what new forms of complexity, perhaps entirely non-linguistic or non-musical as we currently understand them, might be starting to self-organize? What emergent structures are we accidentally kicking off just by making small adaptive shifts in our technological architecture?
Something to ponder. Until the next deep dive, keep listening, not just to the sounds, but to the structures hidden within them.